Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And it's been another great, great week in technology. The iPhone 5S and 5C is out.
I'm really curious to hear what you think, particularly the 5C.
The 5C, and we'll talk about the camera.
Oh.
A big, big upgrade in the camera.
In both phones or just the...
Just the 5C, and they put a lot of...
In the cheaper one?
Oh, no, the 5S.
The 5S,
sorry. Yeah,
okay, 5, all right.
5S, yeah, the more expensive
right.
one. Yeah, the 5S, and it's very similar to the process things you'll get in a high-end digital single-lens reflex.
No kidding.
Pretty nifty what they're doing there with that because they got a 64-bit processor. They got a lot more processing time. Google has come out with some open source software for the Raspberry Pi to help programmers. I think this is a great tool.
Yeah, we talked about that a couple weeks ago. The Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, I think this is a great tool for kids wanting to learn programming. One of the big hackers from Anonymous got 3 years. Which is, he probably deserved it for all that he was doing. And people are talking about the end of Windows XP. It's going to hit its end of life, April 8th, 2014. So we'll talk about what you need to do to prepare for that.
Good.
If you're sitting around just working on, sitting there still with XP, which is, by the way, 13 years old.
Wow.
So it's probably time to leave. And we're going to feature today the man who is behind Dropbox.
Oh, good. Dropbox is cool.
Dropbox is cool. And what is amazing, he has fought back the Apple iCloud, Google Drive, and Microsoft SkyDrive, which is an impressive feat. And, of course, we got a huge mailbag.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Let's get this up here. It's a big mailbag.
It must have rocks
in
there,
right,
too.
We got an email from Wayne Boyer. He's from Tucson, Arizona.
And
he's another podcast listener,
cool.
actually. Dear Tech Doc, I plan to replace my hard drive in my desktop with a solid-state drive. I currently use a Macrum Reflect to image my drive and would like to install the image to a new drive. Is there any setting that I need to any changes that I need to make in the BIOS, when I make this change? Is there any good procedure that I should follow? Love your show. Listen to it every week via podcast. Wayne H. Boyer, Tucson, Arizona. Well, Wayne, the good news is no BIOS changes will actually be required. The solid-state drives are available on a variety of system interfaces. So what happens is it has a hardware piece there that transforms the solid-state drive signals to some sort of standard interface. So your computer just thinks it's a regular old hard drive. And because frequently these are used in conjunction with or interchangeable with magnetic disk drives. And so the solid-state drives come in all types of common interfaces, SATA, Fibre Channel, SAS, or the old ATA, IDA. You can even get a solid-state drive with a USB output if you want to plug it in as an external drive. You got a lot of different interfaces. The type of interface you have really depends on the speed of the solid-state drive. So the old ATA, IDA, IDE is the sort of the slowest one. More than likely, it's going to be an SATA, SATA interface. And you just simply have to make certain that your laptop has the interface, supports the interface that your solid-state drive is connected to. And then you just plop it in there. And your actual, it's just going to look like a magnetic drive to your computer. Now, if you want to leave the old drive in your desktop as kind of a backup drive, and if you want to boot on the solid-state drive, you are going to have to go into the BIOS and select a different boot disk, so it will boot up on the solid state drive instead of on the old drive. That's really just a configuration. So you just go into the BIOS and go into the boot sequence. You can select that, but it's a relatively easy shift. And the solid state drive manufacturers have really designed it to make it easy because they want you to do exactly what you are doing. We got an email from Hawk and Bowie.
Uh-oh, she has ties to those Ohio people, doesn't she?
Yeah, that is a problem. That is a problem. Yes, indeed. Dear Tech Talk, can Google or any other search engine accumulate data on my searches or internet activity? If I don't have a Google account, I'm worried that someone may be watching what I do on the internet.
I knew this was going to be a problem.
Yeah. I don't know what it is with that crew. Love the show, Hawk and Bowie.
All kinds of crazy stuff.
Well, Hawk, when you access any website, the server gets a fair amount of information from your connection to that server and from your browser. Now, this could be the IP address where you're at, the type of browser you're using, its settings, any cookies that were set prior to visits to the site, and possibly some other information. Now, that actually kind of creates a digital fingerprint. So they have a pretty good idea when you go back in there that, you know, this computer, where it's located, the browser. And so they could pretty much identify you, even though they wouldn't identify you by name.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some years ago, search engine data was made available to researchers. They wanted to see whether researchers could figure out who was doing the searches. So they filtered all the IP addresses. They made all the data anonymous. But it turns out that people kind of search for things that kind of give a clue of who they are.
Yeah.
And so it turned out that by cross-referencing the search, these researchers were able to get a pretty good idea of who was doing the searching, even though they didn't exactly know it. So, so the fact is, even though you don't have an account with Gmail specifically, they could probably track down what you're doing from that computer if they wanted to. Now, chances are, nobody's really going to be interested in exactly what you're searching on your, you know, except folks from Tech Talk.
Right. Yeah, sure.
But now, so you don't really have to worry about it unless you're doing, you know, nuclear secrets or something. But this privacy issue is becoming a larger and larger issue because these companies are keeping the search data for a long time, and with the new government program PRISM, they're actually turning that data over, and they're really unable not to turn over the data. So Google was keeping that data because they wanted to deliver ads that you would be interested in. So they keep track of the kind of things that you're searching, then all of a sudden ads related to those things start popping up. And that's viewed as a feature for you and also a real advantage to the Google advertisers.
Sure.
So that's why they keep the data, not really to spy on you. But then with the PRISM situation coming up, the government could get it and spy on you. So,
and we see how that works out these days, don't
we? Yeah. There are some real issues here. And later in the show, I'll get into some recent court cases relating to this. That'll give us some small update in terms of what's going on. We got an email from DQ. Dear Tech Talk, I want to buy the ideal wireless mouse and keyboard combo for my laptop. Either the mouse that I had, either I found the perfect mouse with all the functionality, or I found the perfect keyboard. But I actually couldn't find a combo that had both. So I have to buy them separately. But I don't want to have two USB connectors. You know how these wireless things,
yes,
you plug in a USB?
Yeah.
So is it possible to have two, you know, not get the combo and have mouse A and keyboard B, but only use one wireless USB port on my laptop? Well, here's the thing. First of all, I check whether your laptop had Bluetooth. Then you may not even need a USB connection. And then, you know, if you have Bluetooth, you could just get a Bluetooth mouse and a Bluetooth keyboard. And then there's no issue. Now, if you have an older laptop, you probably don't have Bluetooth, so you are going to have to get a wireless connection. It turns out that all of the wireless peripheral manufacturers have gotten smart enough that they have all their devices support the same standard. So, like, if you go to Logitech, all the Logitech devices, the mice, the wireless mice, the wireless keyboard, all support the same standard. Now, not these are non-Bluetooth devices. They all support the same standard, so you don't have to necessarily get the combo deal. But unfortunately, the standard that they pick is sort of manufacturer-specific.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't get a wireless Logitech device and a wireless Microsoft device and have it work on the same thing. You're going to have to stick within the same manufacturer. But it is possible. And it sounds like, since you're kind of a techie guy, that you probably just could use Bluetooth anyway. We got an email from John in Reston. Dear Doc and Jim, I just got a new laptop and have trouble seeing the fonts. Can I make the screen larger on my Windows 7 laptop? Thanks, John from Reston. Well, John, I had the same problem. We got a new laptop at work, and they installed it. I'm telling you, the fonts were just so tiny. I could hardly read them. I mean, maybe
sit across the room.
Maybe 25 years ago, I could have read them, but. But so what you do is, now changing your screen resolution is really the wrong thing to do. What you want to do, you want your screen resolution to be the native resolution of your monitor. So like if it's 1920 by 1200, that's a typical one, just leave it there.
Okay.
Like if you try to make the image bigger and stretch it, say to make it 1280 by 1024, then what happens, each pixel fills a pixel and a half. I mean, it doesn't exactly map into it exactly right.
No, and it looks kind of, the resolution is off, right?
It looks bigger, but then it looks fuzzy.
Because your display is
trying to figure this out, and it goes one way one time and another way another time when it sort of collects the imaging. So you want to match the resolution of your monitor. So don't make it bigger that way. What you want to do is there is a way to change the font size just by itself, leaving the resolution the same. So what you want to do is right click on your desktop. So you go to the desktop, right click and a menu will come up and click screen resolution. In Windows 7, that's what it. And then once another window will come up, and you'll see something that says "Make text or other items larger or smaller." Click on that, and you have a choice of going 100, 125, or 150% bigger on the text. Actually, I went to 125%. That's what I found. I was really happy with.
It's like reading glasses for you.
Yeah, it is kind of reading glasses. Now, maybe you want to have it like 170%. And so, if you don't like those three choices, then you can actually right click on that thing, and when you click on Make Text Larger or Smaller, and look at that menu, there's something at the bottom called custom DPI link, dots per inch link, and then you can go there and you can set any percentage. You don't have to go with 100, 125, or 150. I found that 150, 125 worked well for me. And then what I did in my browser, I set the browser view at 125. And so the browser view at 125 combined with the 125 text fonts was all I needed. I was quite happy. Now, some applications actually let you use control key, like control plus or control minus. So sometimes if you're in the browser, you can hit control plus and it just makes it bigger. Or control minus, it makes it smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the browsers or email programs, in addition to control plus, control minus, will allow you to use the little scroll wheel, and you can make the image bigger or smaller. So that's a way if you just want to make the image bigger or smaller while you're browsing or looking at one of your email programs. But that's a very nice question.
It's
the same problem that that I had previously. So you were having some issues, Jim. I meant to send you an email last night,
but I fell asleep, which is funny because I fell asleep, and you get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to prepare this show.
That's right. So if you'd have sent it to me last night at 2, I'd have gotten it.
But I think you're going to have the answers to these anyway. Let's start with Bluetooth, with the iPad that I have. I'd like to know if I can use both a Bluetooth speaker and a Bluetooth keyboard at the same time with the iPad. Is that going to work?
Oh, yeah, that'd work. The standard Bluetooth technology is going to support multiple devices.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you can, say, a laptop, you could have a keyboard and a mouse. And that's kind of a standard two-device deal. It supports that. Now, what it won't allow you to do is have two audio channels at the same time. You couldn't put a headphone and a speaker on. You'd have to choose one or the other. but you can easily support it. Now, some people get a little confused because they actually have to pair the devices. So they might pair one device and the other device doesn't work. And so they say it's not working. So you have to pair each device separately.
It can be a little tricky. You have to kind of mess around a little bit when you're pairing with it in the settings on the device, right?
And you have to make the device discoverable.
Right.
So you have to put it in a state where it's discoverable. And then once it's discoverable, they talk. And then you have to put a code in to do the pairing. And, I mean, it's not really that complicated, but it's complicated enough that maybe 25% of the people can't really successfully do it.
This is where reading the instruction comes in really handy, I think.
Yes, that's exactly right. So I've actually paired a Bluetooth keyboard to my iPhone. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a ridiculous thing to do, but I was just curious if I could do it.
I could put
my iPhone on a little stand, and I was actually able to type documents very fast with my iPhone.
It's not ridiculous. It's way more efficient, especially if you're on the go all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I got the iPad mini, was so that I could work on documents, because as much as I love the iPhone and as many things mm-hmm. that it does, the keypad is just so small. And it's funny because now that I've got this, I do more texting on the iPad than I do on the iPhone, because mm-hmm. it takes me forever to accurately type things on the iPhone. So the keyboard makes all the sense in the world.
So for my iPad, I do have a Bluetooth keyboard for my iPad, and it mm-hmm. just and the iPad just fits right in. It's one of those, once it's all integrated together,
yeah.
it's a cover and everything. It is fantastic.
Yeah.
So now when I travel, I really don't need a laptop anymore. I just the iPad with the keyboard becomes my laptop.
Exactly. As you said, and now with the cloud, you don't need to be carrying around thumb drives and disks and all kinds of stuff.
You don't need any of that. The only problem is we don't really have good document generation tools yet. I mean, you've got the Apple, imitation of the Office suite, but it's really not as good as Microsoft Office on there. And so if I'm going to make something really complicated, heavily formatted document, I'm still going to go back to the PC. But just for simple, light formatted, very simply formatted documents without a lot of tables, just bold and stuff, the iPad's perfect for that.
And as you've talked about in the past, when we do some of the back-to-school shows, mm-hmm. And you talk about buying kids laptops, the iPad and the tablets have become really great at that, because when kids lug around all these books to classes and stuff, the last thing you want is a huge laptop to be going with it. So a keyboard and an iPad or a mini iPad or something like that is a great option for things like this.
It works pretty well. A lot of schools are going to also the Chromebooks.
And you know what? A lot of schools ban clearly phones and devices from the classroom. But now mm-hmm. a lot of places, as you have in your workspace, are going to bring your own device.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the way that we're going now.
It works. It works much, much better.
I heard a parent say last week, I don't know why I'm buying paper notebooks anymore, because kids take all their notes on their device and save it that way.
They take the device. And now we're now at Stratford University, we've gone to 70% e-books.
Mm-hmm.
We're gradually transitioning to 100% e-books, but there are just some books that there's some reference books, especially cookbooks and
sure.
things like that, they just don't lend themselves so much to the e-book deal. But I tell you, the e-books are really convenient. And then they're all embedded right into our online platform. So the students log into their online account for that particular class, and the book is right there, and they can read it. But you know what else happens?
What's that?
Now the teacher can tell how long they spend with the book.
No kidding.
Because there's feedback to the instructor.
Huh.
And he says, oh, I see you've only spent 10 minutes reading your book this last week. And so these tools are now used to measure student engagement.
So you encourage students to bring tablets and things like that to the classroom, right?
And read their book, yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't like them to surf the web in class.
No.
See, this is actually always the problem.
Well, that will come out in the end when they don't pass the exams,
yeah,
right?
But that is. So many teachers really don't have so much computer work in class, because there is a tendency to surf the web a little too much when you've got internet access.
So what is your policy? Can kids bring devices to your classes?
Yeah, it's up to the teacher to enforce it.
Really?
I don't have a central
uh-huh.
I don't have a central enforcing rule. I mean, I let instructors do what's best for that particular class, and it varies with the class.
Interesting. Now, obviously, you have several different academic fields that, that you're involved in, but in the technology field, in specific, how does that work? I mean, you guys, they're sitting in a computer lab, though, when they're, when you're doing IT stuff, right?
Yeah, they're sitting in the computer lab, and a lot of the a lot of what they get comes up as a disk image right off our central servers. So we have thin clients set up there. So. No, so they're in a computer lab, but all the computers have internet access.
So how do you feel about this, you know, on a lower academic level, you know, for instance, in junior high and high school, the ability for kids to bring devices to the classroom? Is this a good learning tool or is this more of a distraction at this point?
If the teacher is trained, if the teacher is trained, they can be outstanding learning tools where the kids can actually do research. See, sort of the new trend is kind of this flip the classroom where the kids they read their book and they look at the lecture stuff at home.
Right.
And then when they come to class, they actually work on real problems. So the teacher, if they're working on actually real problems and they're looking up information on the internet while they're solving the problem, the teacher can be there to help them. So having these resources in the classroom, if the teacher knows how to use them, can be very effective. Mm-hmm. The problem has been in, say, K through 12, frequently they just launched all these devices. They didn't train the teachers, and they found out that actually kids learned less.
Interesting.
Because they were kind of playing with them, but they weren't integrated into the curriculum in a proper way.
But in the way that the real world is evolving, that people are using these devices in the business world, wouldn't it seem more... Would it make more sense in the classroom setting so that we're training kids that these are not just things to play games on, but you can do real work on these?
You can. Yeah, that's certainly legitimate. And our librarians, our learning resource centers, they actually spend a lot of time on information literacy, showing kids how to look up information and assess this. There's a lot to that. But, you know, class time, too, is really used for discussion, for critical thinking, and so sometimes having the computer there is not necessarily – it's like, have you ever seen people at four people at dinner, and they're all looking at their smartphone and not talking?
And they're not paying attention to each other.
Yeah.
Right,
so,
yeah.
So I'm actually becoming – we have a lot of technology, but I'm sort of coming down on the fact that having – debates and discussions and looking at problems from multiple directions is in a classroom discussion is probably more productive than looking at the devices.
And that's how you develop critical thinking, right?
That's how you develop critical thinking, because what we found at Stratford is that people get promotions because of critical thinking, and so you get your core skills and then you get your initial job, but then you run into things that you've never seen before, and you've got to think it through in a logical way to draw a conclusion. And it turns out that people that have clarity of thought and know how to think through a process, you know, looking at the eight elements of critical thinking, think through the process and draw a conclusion, they have confidence in that conclusion, so that then they're able to speak it with confidence, and that you know, shows that a leadership sort of trait, and they're the ones selected for promotion. So the critical thinking skills and the soft skills get the promotion, the hard skills get the initial job. So we try to do a lot of that built right into the program, and that's actually what employers want worldwide. They want students to do that.
So it sounds like the way things work now is that you do the homework first, and then you put it into practice in the next class section. Is that correct?
Yeah. Many of our classes are run that way. Mm-hmm. And so you actually have a lot of group discussions. Because let's face it, lectures, I mean, kids just do... Do they really pay attention during a lecture?
Probably not.
So what you want to do is you want to have a short lecture with a lot of group work. You don't want to have all lecture. Some lecture is actually critical, but then you want to have a lot of group work that actually engages the students. And I like to say the true value of education is what's left after you've forgotten everything you memorized.
Interesting.
In other words, how did it change the way you think?
Right, how it wires your brain to solve problems.
That's exactly right.
So the other question was, we talked early in the summer about smart watches, and I recall that basically your takeaway from that was that smart watches really aren't soup yet. They're not really they're probably not worth spending the money on. Is there anything out there now? I'm looking for something as a gift that would be compatible with an Apple device. Is there anything out there? Is it worth it? And if not, is Apple going to get into this game?
I think Apple is very close to releasing their iWatch.
Really?
Yeah, they're very close to that. It's rumored to be about $300.
Uh-huh.
It's a little on the steep side.
Uh-huh.
But they're rumored to do that. There was this Pebble smartwatch that was crowdsourced that we talked about a while ago. And so there are other smartwatches that work with the Android, and you have to decide what you want the smartwatch to do. I mean, you really don't want to browse the internet with your watch.
It's too small.
It's too small. And the other thing, these smartwatches all look a little clunky because they're fairly big.
Yeah.
So some of them. And it doesn't really make sense to talk into your watch like the Dick Tracy watch. So
Inspector Gadget.
So the smartwatch is really not used for, I think, talking. I mean, you're still going to answer the phone. But many of them have a button on them where if you decide you don't want to answer the phone, you can just, press the button, shut it off. What's very nice is that you can read text messages that come through to your. So you can sit there instead of, it's a pain when, you watch somebody always looking at their text messages.
You can.
So they can kind of look down at their
watch
and they can read their text messages. It's like a secret way to look at text messages.
I think she's interested in it for that, for Twitter, also probably to listen to music on while she's on the go.
Yeah, I guess but you would. But the thing is, you still have to have your iPhone.
To pair with it?
Well, see, so you've got an iPhone speaker, so I'm not convinced
that's
listening
true.
To music even makes any sense.
No.
So what I've seen is you can control the music.
It's sort of like a remote control.
Yeah, so you've got like start, stop, go to the next item. So it's really, I don't think it really makes sense for it to have a speaker in it, for it to have a microphone in it. It just controls your iPhone. And I'm not convinced they figured out a real useful application
for the smartwatch
that would actually, in the long term, just be something. Say, hey, boy, I've just got to have that. I mean, the smartwatches are so big, you could almost just get.
How big are they? They're so big.
They're probably an inch, an inch and a quarter by an inch and a quarter.
Well, I think she kind of likes the chunky, geeky aspect
of
that.
So the ultimate smartwatch, Jim, would be to just get a wristband and put your entire smartphone on your wrist.
If I had my iPad Nano the iPod Nano, they actually did make a watch band for that. And
you could
do
that. And then you could actually get a clock face for your iPhone. So you'd have this giant
watch
on your iPhone, and then you can see the text messages directly.
Or you could go to like the world map that they have on there with the different time zones. That would look kind of cool.
That's right.
Except you break your wrist.
So I think if she's really into this total slick integration with the iPhone, I'd wait for the iWatch to come out because it's imminent.
It's
imminent.
Really? Wow.
So what they're saying is that it's in the same rumor roundup as the 5S, 5C. So it's very close.
Wow.
It's very close. But I don't think they released it last week.
No, they didn't. Just the S and the C.
Just the S and the C. But it is getting very close. And so I'll bet it's out before Christmas.
No kidding. Well, that would make sense from a marketing standpoint.
I'm thinking it's going to be out before Christmas. And so I'm thinking that is going to be the way to go. So there's been rumors of this for a long, long time. And, it's going to be a 1.5 to 2 inch display.
Wow, still big. You're like carrying a jumbotron on your wrist.
And it's also going to have biometric functionality.
That I think she'd like.
So you can be used as a fitness tracking device.
She'd love that because she has the Nike thing on her.
Oh, it's not going to debut till the end of 2014. So it's a little bit.
Thanks for getting me all worked up.
Sorry. Christmas. I was only off by one year.
One Christmas.
Okay, it's going to be there for Christmas of 2014.
Gotcha.
So you you could get the Pebble device, which is a cheaper device, and you could get that as kind of tied her over until the iWatch comes out.
That way she could, that'd be fun.
Then play around with it.
Exactly. Okay. Very good. Doc, you are doing more than just conducting the Classroom of the Airwaves.
I am tracking Tech Talk Online on Facebook. So go to facebook.com/Tech Talk Online. We'll look at your comments during the show. Also, we love your emails. Send emails to techtalk@stratford.edu.
This is indeed Tech Talk Radio, heard every Saturday on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Back right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Today we're going to be talking about Andrew W. Huston. They don't say it's Houston. Is there a road, a street?
Houston.
In
New York, how they pronounce
it. The same
as Houston.
Houston, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's pronounced just like the road in New York. Andrew W. Houston. They call him Drew.
His mom doesn't. She calls him
she
Andrew
calls him
W.
Andrew W. Andrew W. Drew Houston is best known as co-founder and CEO of Dropbox, an online backup and storage service. Drew Houston was born in Acton, Massachusetts in 1983. Growing up in the suburbs of Boston, he began tinkering at age 5 with an IBM PC Junior. But his mom got worried about him. She correctly deduced that her son was becoming a code geek.
Uh-huh.
And she wanted to make him more balanced. So she made him take French, learn French, and she wanted to hang out with jocks.
And Wait a minute, these two things don't match.
Well, she
wanted more to be diversified.
No, she wanted to be around it instead of just being a guy that coded 24/7.
Gotcha.
And and when he wanted to skip a grade because he was like moving through it so quickly, she refused to let him do it. At 14, Houston signed up to beta test an online game and began rooting out security flaws. They soon hired him as their networking program. This was at age 14.
Right.
In exchange for equity in the company.
Good grief.
He attended Acton Boxborough Regional High School in the 1990s. In 2005, Drew made his mother very happy when he graduated from MIT with a degree in computer science. And he was a member of the Phi Delta Theta fraternity. Now, this was an interesting thing. He spent a lot of time at the fraternity. A lot of his fraternity buds were ones that he worked with in starting the company. And he used to go up on the roof of the fraternity, and there was an old green lawn chair. And he'd sit up there on the roof in this green lawn chair. And even though he was a computer guy, he started buying all of these business books. And he'd sit up there reading business books because he wanted to basically run a big computer company. That was his dream. And he sort of got he called it the rooftop MBA while he was going through school. Now he worked on several startups throughout high school and college. Dropbox was actually his sixth startup. He
Good
worked
grief.
On Bit9 was one, Bit number nine. He worked on Accolade, and he worked on HubSpot. These were three that he did prior to Dropbox. Now, Houston conceived of Dropbox on a bus trip from Boston to New York. He had been planning to do a lot of work on his homework. He had all of his documents on the USB drive. And, I mean, on the bus he had an internet connection, but then he forgot his USB drive.
Really?
So he couldn't work on any of his documents, and he was just fed up with that. He said, wouldn't it be nice if I could have access my documents here right on the bus? You know, he's probably using on Bolt Bus or one of these.
Right, they got Wi-Fi on it.
That's got Wi-Fi on it, yeah. And so he opened up the text editor, and he started writing the first lines of code for a document sharing, because he just loved to code. And that was the beginning of Dropbox.
Mm-hmm.
So he made kind of a beta version of this Dropbox that he was doing this thing, and while he was still at MIT, he showed an early version of Dropbox to a friend of his, Arash Ferdowsi, and the two of them decided, well, we could probably make a business out of this.
Mm-hmm.
So they co-founded Dropbox. Arash was chief technical officer, and then of course Drew, or as his mother called him, Andrew, was
Andrew
the
W.
CEO. Andrew W. Yeah, I couldn't find out what the W meant. It's well hidden on the internet. You might be able to find that up. I tried to figure that out.
I can, but I'll check.
You check it out. I mean, you may be able to use your techniques.
I think I'll call our friends in Ohio to help us with that.
Okay, that would be very good. Houston founded Dropbox Incorporated in June of 2007, and shortly thereafter secured seed funding from Y Combinator. And they got about $15,000 from Y Combinator. Not a big amount, but it was enough to get started. And they once they got their seed funding, they moved into a little apartment there in Cambridge and started working on the project, you know, quite happy. But they knew all the action was out at Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
So they moved to San Francisco, and they received their first venture capital investment from Sequoia Capital. Sequoia, of course, they were early investors in Google and Apple. Dropbox officially launched as a product in 2008. At TechCrunch 50, which was a technical conference. Now, due to trademark disputes, Dropbox's official domain name was getdropbox.com until October of 2009, when they acquired their current domain of dropbox.com. Now, when he was trying to market this thing, his problem was that people who could use it didn't know they needed it. So it was very, very hard to market. So the traditional marketing he didn't feel would work. He made this sort of this little video of like screenshots, and he talked about it, and he had a lot of like geeky files that he was uploading that were well known to the dig community in particular. And he ran this little video. And it went viral because of all the dig references in it, D-I-G-G. And so while it was still in beta, he went from 4,000 people that requested beta to 75,000 overnight. And so this thing sort of grew through referrals. Now, in December of 2009, there was beginning to get some traction out there in Silicon Valley. Steve Jobs had one of his direct reports go locate Drew at the local bar.
Mm-hmm.
They tended to go to the bar at the W Hotel.
Maybe it's Andrew W Hotel Houston.
Maybe it's because he liked the bar at the W. Yeah, you know, maybe that's where that came from. I don't think, you know.
We're just being silly, folks.
His mother would never.
No, she'd never name him after a bar.
No, she wouldn't do that. So that's a. So then,
Andrew, 2 o'clock, Club Houston. So they. No, that doesn't work.
So Steve's first report knew where to get Drew, went to the W, found him, and he says, you know, Steve Jobs, I'd like to talk to you. So I said, wow. So he went and talked to Steve Jobs, and Jobs. So he wanted to show him Dropbox, and Jobs said, I know all about that. Steve Jobs said, you know, I just wanted to let you know that we're going to bury you. We're going to go we're going to go over exactly what you're doing. And it's probably wise for you just to let us buy your company now.
No kidding.
Yeah. And
so Jobs was talking about the cloud is what he was talking about.
The iCloud,
right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so Andrew Houston, he says, well, Mr. Jobs, I don't know what he called him.
Probably not Mr. Jobs.
Steve Jobs was actually his idol. I mean, it was like a dream come true to talk to Steve.
And then it gets shot down like that? Wow.
Yeah. Well, it was sort of the ultimate compliment because Steve Jobs was saying that his software did not suck. I mean, he was saying it was really a very good compliment.
Which, as we all know, is when Steve Jobs says, it does not suck. That is the ultimate compliment
for
Steve Jobs.
That is. That's as good as it gets with Steve. So then he said, no, I'm going to build a big company. And I'm not going to sell it. I'm going to have a big company. And then Steve Jobs said, you know, there's a lot of work to build a big company. It's a lot different than a startup. And so he said, okay. So he left. And in June of 2011, June of 2011, Apple launched iCloud, and they in the blogs it references the exact language that Drew used when he saw that, which I can't give on the air. And so that was a major affront because you see, all of the iPhone devices were automatically synced to the iCloud. There was no way to hook it to something else.
Anything else, right?
And in addition, he knew that Google was working on their drive, and they would want to have all the Android devices synced directly to the Google Drive. So Google Drive launched in April of 2012. So Dropbox either had to scale or be crushed.
Wow.
You see, and there are a lot of like 1 minute wonders in the tech business.
Sure.
And Drew did not want to become a 1 minute, 1 minute wonder. And so he then resolved to really scale this thing. That meant he had to get it on all of these different platforms. So first of all, he solved the freemium riddle, where you give something away free, but then you get people to pay. So what was so clever? He gave away, a few gigabytes of storage, but he found out that very quickly people started putting more and more stuff on, and then they would buy for $10 a month additional storage. And so the conversion to paid model was fairly good. So he was in 2011, the Dropbox revenue was $240 million, and 96% of their users were free. Mm-hmm. So that was from only 4% of their users. So even if they got no more users, he estimated that the next year his revenue would go up to $500 million. So it was actually a pretty good model. So in August of 2011, he had to accelerate this penetration if he was going to keep from being crushed. So he went to the top VCs in Silicon Valley. These are all the top guys you've heard out there. And he said, all right, guys, I want to raise money. I want to put metal to the pedal here. And he said, I'll give you till, and he gave them a tour of the place, showed them what they were doing, their projections. He said, I'll give you till next Tuesday to get back to me. Well, Monday night, nothing, they hadn't received anything. And his co-founder, Arash, said, Drew, do you think maybe we should withdraw this offer? You know, nobody's getting back to us. And Drew said, nope, I said Tuesday, and it's not Tuesday yet. So the next day, all five came back. They valued the company at $4 billion.
Wow.
And so he raised $250 million, which is like less than 10% of the company. He got $250 million and only had to give away less than 10% of the company. And then he had money. So they moved out of this little, and they at that point, they only had 70 employees or fewer. So they moved to, you know, fancy place. And so, but then he had to then really start moving. So first of all, he struck a deal with SoftBank and Sony Ericsson to become preloaded on their mobile phones. He's trying to go after the Android deal. Mm-hmm. He had to penetrate the Android market. Then he in April of 2012, Dropbox announced a new feature to automatically upload photos, and they gave away 3 gigabytes of free space. And this was a move directly designed to go against the Google Drive and the Microsoft SkyDrive. On September 26th of 2012, Facebook and Dropbox integrated, so they could actually, you know, download or upload material directly to and from Dropbox from Facebook. On November 12, 2012, Dropbox announced that it had reached 100 million users. So what they have done, they call themselves the Switzerland of cloud storage. So you can store material, you can store it to the Microsoft SkyDrive as well as to Dropbox. You can store it to Google Drive as well as to Dropbox. You can store it to the iCloud as well as Dropbox. So it actually talks to everybody. And so it's the Switzerland of cloud storage.
I like this.
And he's actually been very successful at building this company and fighting off this huge deal, but he had to learn how to build the company by growing quickly and integrating quickly in as many platforms as possible. Drew's net worth. Oh, by the way, his partner dropped out of MIT because see, Drew had graduated. I'm sure his mom made sure of that.
Absolutely.
And so Drew had graduated, but his partner Arash Ferdowsi, he actually dropped out to form the company. So Drew's net worth is estimated to be $400 million as of August 2013, and he's, I think, what is this, 83? So he's about 30 years old.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
Not bad at all.
Not bad. So Andrew W. Houston did an excellent job of building Dropbox.
Yep. Hope you're paying attention because we're going to move rapidly here, and you'll have your chance to win free food for knowledge here as we play the pop quiz on Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, coming right up after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to Classroom of the Airways.
Yes.
Those of you that have been with us for a while know that. Our new listeners might have thought this was a radio show, but no, it's a classroom. And if there's a classroom, there is going to be an assessment.
Yes.
And that is assessment we call a pop quiz. If you get the correct answer to this pop quiz, not only will you get an A for the day, you'll win two tickets to fine dining at the Escoffier Dining Room or at the Karim Dining Room at the Stratford campuses. Now, earlier in the show, I was talking about Andrew W. Houseman, co-founder and CEO of Dropbox. And he built Dropbox up, and he liked to call it with this particular nickname. What nickname did he give to Dropbox?
No, you need to call us right away with that answer. And the number is, if you're calling from east of Acton, Boxborough, Massachusetts, it's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from a bulk bus, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, anywhere else, the wild card line is 877-936-9333. Thick cheese.
Yes. And then, of course, if you're calling from South Africa, you might want to use Skype, and you can simply connect to Tech Talk Radio 1, and that will be forwarded directly to the studio.
Call now, quickly, please, 877-936-9333.
So let's talk about a new device which was just announced, the USB condom that protects your device, the USB condom. Now, have you ever noticed they've got these charging kiosks around? And you can plug your USB port into a charging kiosk to charge your cell phone. Well, the problem is the connections on that USB port not only have power connections, they also have data connections. And so there have been cases where there have been kiosks which have actually used that opportunity to upload malware into your phone or else pull data out of your phone. And so in order to protect you from that, they have what they call the USB condom. And you put your USB port into the condom, and it blocks the data connections, and only the power connections are allowed to go through. This device is going – that's called juice jacking. if you plug it into a kiosk that tries to hijack your device, it's called juice jacking because, you know, it's a charging device. So this is going on sale, and it's built by INT3-CC. That's the company. Mm-hmm. It's going to be released and go on sale in the next month or so. So there you go.
Gotcha. Doc, we don't have a winner yet, so let's ask the question one more time.
Earlier in the show, we talked about the CEO and founder of Dropbox, Andrew Houston. And he built this device to actually interoperate with Microsoft, with Google, and with Apple Cloud Storage. You could talk to all of them. And so he nicknamed it the something of cloud storage.
Exactly. Tell you what we're going to do is we're just going to stay here to the end of the show because you have a lot of stuff to talk about and a lot
yes,
of Apple
indeed.
News. So we're just going to, if we get a winner during the Apple discussion, we'll take that and we'll just continue right on into
good.
The end of the show here. Now,
so the
okay?
two new iPhones went on sale on Friday, the 13th. I don't know why they picked that.
That's a weird day, isn't it?
Yeah, Friday the 13th.
Oh, you know what? I should give the number. It's 877-936-9333. Sorry to interrupt.
You know, I was reading, there was, talking about Friday the 13th, there was this one flight that flies into Helsinki.
Yes.
Did you see that?
Yes.
Flight 666 to hell.
Helsinki, which is H-E-L is the airport code,
that's
right?
That's right. On Friday the 13th. That's right. Well, after the iPhones were announced and went on sale on Friday the 13th, Apple shares actually fell. Because the analysts were wondering whether the iPhone 5C was cheap enough to compete on the Chinese market and whether the iPhone 5S had sufficient increased capability to be worth the upgrade. And so they were a little, I guess the market showed somewhat disappointment. Now, the new 5C's plastic body was really the design choice of Apple's design guru, Sir Johnny Ives. And it was his attempt to produce a budget model. But actually, the budget model, it's only about $60 cheaper.
Right.
It's not really that much of a budget model.
No, it's still, what is it, 500-some bucks if you're just going to pay outright for it?
Yeah, it's just like $60, $70 cheaper. So that's why they were saying it's not that much difference.
Yeah.
But it has a plastic case. Now, the 5... The 5S has upgraded its camera. Now, this was really expected because there's a lot of competition in the sort of the camera space. It also added something that I like, a fingerprint scanner.
Yeah.
So you can actually lock your phone and you just rub your finger over the button when you want to open it. You don't have to put in the code, which is actually quite a nice feature. And you can also use the fingerprint as authorization for purchases from Apple's App Store. Also, it comes, this is very significant, with a more powerful 64-bit processor. That makes a big difference, especially for image processing. That means the 5S is just faster. It's got better. It's got as much computing power as a laptop or a desktop. Primarily, it's going to initially just be used on image processing and games, but later on, it's going to be, you know, other applications are going to be written for it. Now, the 5C is available in 5 colors because they're trying to appeal to a different demographic,
sure,
including pink and green.
Mm-hmm.
The 5S is available in gold. So there is a marked movement away from Steve Jobs' favorite colors, black and white.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'd say Jobs would never have approved this color standard.
Interesting.
It turns out that gold is a popular color in China and India, and the plastic colors will further extend their brand in the West, that like all these bright greens and reds and pinks.
You know, some of the speculation I heard this week is some are saying that the cheapening thing could backfire on Apple, even though it's really not that much cheaper. But plastic, some of these other high-end firms that have tried to offer something that's not as good, it in the long run backfires. What do you think?
Yeah, it may not be successful. I haven't had a chance to hold it. But Johnny Ives is a good designer.
Yeah.
So I've got a lot of confidence in him, but I think they could have cheapened it in a way other than just with the case.
Sure, okay.
So let's look at what the iPhone 5S camera features are. This is the big deal. Okay, the sensor in the iPhone 5S is still 8 megapixels, but the individual pixels have been enlarged to 1.5 microns, which is up from the previous size of 1.4 microns. So a bigger pixel means that they collect more light, so you can do better low light pictures. So the active surface area of the sensor has been increased by about 50%, and that means they've got more light sensitivity. Now, Apple says this adds about a 33% increase to the overall light sensitivity. The iPhone 5S features a 5-element lens, which Apple described as new because it actually has to cover a larger chip.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the lens is an aperture of f-stop of f2.2, which is a little bit faster than the previous phone, so you get about a 50% gain in terms of light on the system. So low light sensitivity is a big deal. Now, because of the processor, it's got some really sophisticated things. We have now dynamic tone mapping. Now, this means that it will, like in the dark area of the photograph, it will map the tone, and in the bright area, it will map the tone, so it increases the dynamic range.
Wow.
So, like, if you've got a subject with a bright background, you can actually, you'll have a much higher dynamic range. And this has always been a problem with this, and only the high-end digitals had something else. It also is an autofocus matrix. That means it has focus zones, so it can zoom in quicker. It has a multi-shot feature, so it will take 3 or 4 pictures at once. It will pick the one that is the best in focus and keep it. And it can take parts of pictures and put them together dynamically. That's because of this LED. It has a true tone flash. It has 2 LEDs with two different skin colors, and it can dynamically adjust the tone of the flash based on the situation. It's got a burst mode, it's got slow motion video, and a new stabilization algorithm. Well, listen, this show is up. That's a great camera. Listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu. And we'd love you to check out the Stratford programs. Go to stratford.edu to check out those programs. You can also, at techtalkonline.com, you can sign up for the podcast. Or you can go to Apple iTunes and sign up to the podcast.
We stumped everybody this week. The answer was the Switzerland of cloud devices. So we'll try again next week. Tune in next week for another edition of Tech Talk. And, of course, if you missed the show, you can hear it again, replayed tomorrow at 6. We'll be back next week.
commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT-FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Navy football on the air today. The coaches show at 2 o'clock, 3:30 for kickoff. The Navy midshipmen take on the Fighting Neat Blue Hens of the University of Delaware. Sunny, nice today, low 70s. Right now, 61 outside our studios at 10 a.m.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility.